Universe Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nimmers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Nailers Natter. And this week, I am talking to Kat Stern. Kat Stern consults on behaviour in secondary educational settings, and having trained as a PE teacher, Kat spent all of her teaching career working in inner city areas of high deprivation. For 4 years, she ran a provision for students at a risk of exclusion and was a director for teaching and learning for behaviour in a large academy. She then spent some time consulting for Young Offenders Institute and is currently working on a trauma-informed research project in a pupil referral unit, as well as delivering training and consultancy across the spectrum from selective schools to alternative provision. And the book we are looking at today is Kat's book, The Excludables. And there's a very prescient quote at the back of the book, and it says, "Ideas that require people to reorganize their picture of the world provoke hostility." Whilst I'm not expecting hostility, particularly for this podcast, this will be something that's going to make you think. So the bio from the back of the book talks about the book, and it says, "When it comes to the excludables, it's time to shake up the debate. Students who are excluded from school are at a higher risk of being incarcerated. They are more likely to have mental health difficulties, special educational needs, live in poverty, and have social care involvement. This book pulls on all the threads using up-to-date research and establishes a deeper understanding of how and why these factors affect school behaviours. So be ready to explore brain scans, genetics, resilience, bias, trust, and the margins of our educational system. This book will confront everyone in some way." Absolutely. So I'm looking very much forward to speaking to Kat, and you can hear this conversation right after our latest plug for both Research Ed Blackpool, tickets available, and also the Nailers Natter book.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Nailers Natter the book, ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Nailers Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them, and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Okay, so hello, Kat, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Phil. Thank you for having me on.
No problem at all. No problem at all. Okay, so the book we're going to be talking about today is going to be Kat's book, which is The Excludables, From Mainstream Classroom to Prison Education. And this is a John Kat book. So before we get into this, Kat, and I've got a lot to ask you about this, could we just do the gentle introductory question? So just tell listeners a little bit about you and your journey in education to this point.
Sure. So I trained as a PE teacher. My first school was 11% 5A star to C. So I think it was the second academy ever built. And quickly, I kind of focused in on pastoral care and behaviour and definitely went down that route. So I spent most of my career in large inner city academies, became a lead teacher for behaviour, then a director of teaching and learning for behaviour. I spent 4 years running what's now called an internal AP, which is effectively a separate provision within a very large academy for children who are at risk of exclusion. And obviously that plays quite a role in what I've written about. Also school, sometimes called school refusers as well. And then ended up consulting on behaviour in secondary education settings from kind of mainstream to alternative provision. And within that, I spent quite a few months consulting for the education setting in a Young Offenders Institute. So it's a kind of broad look, I guess the theme of the book is a broad look at children who are excluded, not just from school, but who are excluded from society. However, they are still educated by teachers such as you and me. So it's been a really fascinating journey to be on, and I'm still learning a huge amount, which is, you know, one of the themes of the book really is how much more out there is for us to learn when it comes to student behaviour.
Definitely. And obviously the kind of title of the podcast is Talking to Teachers, and we're talking about academic research and evidence as well. And this is certainly in that category, Kat, isn't it, in terms of the amount of time, effort and, you know, research and evidence that have gone into the production of this book alongside, obviously, your experience as well.
Yeah, there's just under 500 references in the book, and the vast majority of those are research studies in journals. So, you know, if for no other reason, you know, to buy the book, if you are interested in really digging into the research behind behavior, this is absolutely, you know, I'd recommend it, because even if you don't like what I've written, there are so many rabbit holes to fall down. There is research around trust, resilience, bias. You know, there's so much, obviously, the data that we have on exclusions, but also going far deeper than that, you know, stress and special educational needs. And there's so many avenues to explore. And like, personally, I find it fascinating. I know that other people, you know, are really interested in these big questions as well.
Absolutely. And just for full disclosure, in terms of, I know people think that when we do the podcast that I get sent lots of books and therefore I speak to people about them because I'm being paid some huge amount by many different publishers. Not true, listener. I actually found this book. I actually went and ordered this book. I actually read this book. And then I got in touch with Kat and said, please, will you come and have a chat with me about this? And we had a couple of false starts, and but in the Easter holidays, we finally got there. Finally got there. So thanks again, Kat.
Yeah, I mean, now I feel bad for not sending you a free copy, but I don't have very many free copies, so apologies for that.
That's exactly the point of it. Don't feel bad about that, because that's what I mean. If I'm interested enough to want to go out and buy the book, that's the reason I wanted to speak to you in the first place, because as we said off air, you know, we are involved in these kind of things on a daily basis in school. So this is certainly something that I wanted to read, and obviously having a chat with you is hopefully going to inspire lots of other people to want to go out there and get the book and have a read as well.
Yeah, and that's where I think what you do is so valuable in terms of, you know, giving people this kind of like insight first that does encourage people to go, yes, that is something I'd like to read more about, or not necessarily, that might be something I think I disagree with, or, you know, something that might challenge me, therefore maybe it's worth a look. So yeah, I'm really grateful.
No problem. And just on that particular theme, and it's something that I've just done in the kind of introduction to the podcast before you came on, the quote at the end of the book, it says, ideas that require people to reorganize their picture of the world provoke hostility. And whilst we're not expecting hostility within the podcast, we're certainly expecting a few things that might challenge people's thinking. And that's another reason, obviously, for getting you on the podcast.
Absolutely. Exclusion from school ultimately is a moral judgment. And that is one of the reasons, and it's a subjective moral judgment, and that's why it can be so divisive, why it's so emotive. People feel very, very strongly, not just about exclusion, but about behavior within school. And I think one of the reasons that we feel so strongly about it, particularly those of us who are directly involved kind of at the chalk face, is that it can feel threatening, and it can unsettle us, and it can stress us out. In fact, I'm going to say it does stress us out. And so... it's such an emotional topic to start with. And I think that's one of the reasons why people can be quite hostile to others who have an opposing view on behavior, is because they are afraid of what the consequences of that perspective might mean for them. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so let's get into the questions then, Kat. And the first one is a massive question, and a massive question probably requires a long answer. So are exclusions to be desired, tolerated, or eliminated?
Okay, desired, tolerated, or eliminated. I think it's probably easier to just give, you know, my personal perspective on that. And I think that is that there have been a very, very, very small number of occasions where I have supported the immediate removal of a student from a school setting. And would continue to support that. I've been involved, as I mentioned in my kind of bio, with children at risk of exclusion many, 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 many times. And yes, a lot of them have been excluded. Do I think that that was the right course of action personally? No. So I would say, as I do say at the end of my book, the vast majority of exclusions, in my opinion, compound harm on some of the most vulnerable children who require the most support. So in that sense, I think that exclusions are not going to go away. Whether they are too high or too low is a really complicated question. And that kind of links us into the data, because exclusions is publicly available data. However, is it an accurate and truthful picture of how many children have been forced or pushed or moved out of mainstream education? Absolutely not. And there's a ton of evidence in the book that, you know, will tell you that it is not. So it is not the full picture. And that is clearly going to be much higher than the recorded permanent exclusion data. So the book starts with a statistic, which is just pre-pandemic, you know, 2 children in 1,000 is the average in a secondary state-funded school. Is that the actual number? No. Just because something is not called a permanent exclusion does not mean functionally it isn't a permanent exclusion. So the numbers will definitely be higher than whatever that data set suggests.
Absolutely. So in terms of, I mean, you mentioned that a lot of the studies that you've looked into obviously are pre-pandemic, and obviously anecdotally from conversations that I've had both on the podcast, at conferences, just, you know, with other colleagues, do you feel as if the number of exclusions potentially are rising as a result of the return to school, or is that something that you'd rather stick to the research and rather than offer anecdotes about that?
Yeah, I mean, all we've got at this point is a prediction, isn't it? In terms of, I think, feedback that I'm hearing from within schools, people are, on the whole, I think, finding a high level of behavioural challenge. But you have to remember that you have a staff body who is also disproportionately stressed and who has also just been through a pandemic. And that affects our behaviour as well. So I guess if I had to, you know, gamble, I would say that, yes, I think exclusion data will rise. Certainly this academic year, we won't have it for a little while. But part of that will be because there's more children in school. So how much it will rise, I don't know. There was an interesting study, actually, that's not in the book, that's relatively recent, that looked at the well-being of children through the early kind of year of the pandemic. And actually, it was quite interesting. It found that a third of the children actually improved in terms of well-being when they were predominantly in lockdown and remote learning. And a third of children deteriorated. So I think my concern is that the third of the children who were actually doing better in terms of their well-being when not in school environment will have now returned to the school environment. And the children who deteriorated may not have recovered from that deterioration. And then, as I said, you have this support, the people who are holding all of this together, who have had, you know, almost no relief from the stress of what they've been through in terms of education and how to deliver it over the past couple of years. So I guess that tells you what my prediction is that the amount of stress in our student population is higher, the amount of stress in our staff population is higher, therefore exclusions, I would suggest, will probably rise. But obviously, we can wait and see.
Yeah, indeed. And that kind of leads on to the next question. And you talk about it in the book. So is the biggest, most fundamentally flawed assumption of all that we all interpret behaviour objectively? And that links into what you're talking about there with, you know, post-pandemic stress, both for students and for teachers.
Yes. So we are, you know, creatures of bias, and we are actually, I think most laboratory studies would suggest that we're pretty terrible at sometimes even understanding our own actions. One of the fascinating things I look at in the book, in the chapter on bias, is how stress affects our judgment of things. And that section includes studies from the justice sector, from the medical sector, obviously from the education sector. You know, it's a human trait. And one of the things that we've learned through those studies is that stress affects our judgment in subtle and subconscious ways. And in the sense of when you have a student in front of you who's committed some kind of misdemeanor or challenged you in terms of behavior, we can attribute that to their character. We can attribute that to their disposition, effectively.
Nailers, natter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, so what I mean by it's very easy and quick for us to do that, it literally requires less of us. It requires less energy. It requires less activity in the prefrontal cortex of our brain. And that is effectively our fallback. So what we do is we rely on quick, easy character judgments about other people when we are more stressed, when we are more distracted. Essentially, it's a fault in their character. Now, in order to judge someone's behavior or the way they've interacted with us and attribute it to their situation actually requires more of us. It requires more energy. It requires more activity in the prefrontal cortex. It takes evidence. It needs us carefully unpicking that situation. So really, that's a kind of constant state of flux that we find ourselves in a job like teaching, where our level of regulation or dysregulation impacts how we interpret the world around us. And once we understand that, it's very easy to then understand the same is true of our students. So they interpret us differently when they are stressed, when they are dysregulated. And that kind of links nicely into the chapter on trust, really, epistemic trust, and how some students are or find it very, very difficult to believe we are credible and to place their trust in us, that we can keep them safe and that the advice that we're giving them is advice that should be meaningful to them.
Definitely. And it's such an interesting point that, and obviously we've just finished, or at the time of recording, for the Easter holidays, and you can feel yourself in some of the judgments, and I've been doing this for 22 years, Kat, now, so you can feel that with a bit of experience, you do recognise and realise when perhaps you're not functioning fully, and it's been an extremely challenging and difficult and stressful term, and you do have that capacity to make decisions based on your experience. But that's not always the case, particularly with new teachers, early careers teachers, that kind of thing. So it's really interesting that, you know, that flawed assumption that we all do interpret behaviour objectively, whether it's, you know, the first day of term, the last day of term, the first lesson in the morning, the last one in the afternoon. It's a really interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great study in there that looked at parole decisions and how they fluctuated through the day. And like, we're talking massive fluctuations, and even things like having a lower blood sugar level impacts the way that we think and the way that we respond. So if you are hungry during the day, if you are dehydrated during the day, and these are parts of our everyday experience. So actually, when you dig down really into the kind of fine print, the way that we respond to any given student in any given moment about, you know, one objective behavior can vary so widely. And that, you know, that is something that we have to work with, and that's part of our experience.
Absolutely. Okay, now something I'm interested in from a personal viewpoint here, we don't often do a personal viewpoint on the podcast, but I work in a school which has close to 75% of students that are receiving free school meals, which I think is probably quite a high proportion considering across the country. But I'm really interested whether there's a correlation between free school meals and permanent exclusion, and whether you've got enough research and evidence to attribute correlation in some way to that.
Yeah, so the first chapter of the book, for a lot of reasons, I chose it to be the first chapter, is to do with poverty, really. So the first question you're asking in terms of free school meals, that's a binary. You either are eligible and receive them, or you're not. And what we can say is that children who are eligible and receive free school meals are far more likely to be permanently excluded than children, the group of children who do not. So that gives us a binary. When we look at correlation, that's actually one of the most fascinating pieces of data in the entire book to me. So if we take all of the secondary schools, for example, which is where most exclusion happens, and we look at the area that they are in. And what the data does, the national data, is that it essentially puts in 10 different blocks, so deciles of affluence. So with one being the least affluent or the poorest, and block 10 being the most affluent. If you then put all of the schools in their respective block and you look at the average exclusion rates of those blocks, it is as close to a perfect correlation as you can get. For those people who understand correlations, the strongest they can be is 1 or -1. And the one that I picked out just before the pandemic was, I think, -0.97. So if we look at the big picture, the level of affluence in school areas is massively connected to exclusion. And it's possible to infer, or you can hypothesize, that it also maps to levels of challenging behavior across our system. So what that correlation does is it tells us not just that poverty matters, and it's not just that extreme affluence matters, it's all the steps in between matter. Now, if you are an educator who's bounced around different schools and you've been to, you know, schools within areas of lots of different levels of affluence, that might seem completely understandable to say that there are more a higher volume of challenging behaviors in schools who are higher in terms of deprivation. But it's quite stark to think that that relationship is so strong and so beautifully correlated across our whole system. So I guess that's our system, but you kind of want to break it down and go, okay, at a family level, does it matter? So overall, when families move into poverty or fall below the poverty line, there is a significant increase in the odds that their child will start to show, quote, behavioral problems. And that's a beautiful piece of research picked out of a massive, massive study. In fact, multiple cohort studies that kind of about 833 families who weren't living in poverty when their child was three and then unfortunately transitioned into poverty. So what you can't do is say at an individual level, poverty predicts anything. That is, you know, there is no research in the book that is going to tell you you can predict it at an individual level. However, as a group, you absolutely cannot, you can predict not only that there will be differences in terms of behavior, but that there are differences in memory, attention, language development, differences in hyperactivity and conduct problems and peer problems. And there's some beautiful studies in the book. And again, I highly recommend you buy it. But that kind of show these like mapped wonderfully to different levels of socioeconomic status, not just do you get free school meals or do you not? So what this kind of raises for me is a really fascinating question. So I use an example. Phil, let's say you're the head teacher of a school and you are comfortable in terms of your behavior policy and the systems, and you feel like, you know, might not be perfect, but you've got it pretty sorted. You're now going to move to a different school, and that different school may be several levels of kind of lower in terms of affluence or higher in terms of deprivation. The question becomes, knowing all of those differences at a group level, would you do anything differently? And if you would do anything differently, what would you do differently?
I think I've lived that. And I said off air that I wasn't going to do any personal discussions, but I think I have lived that reality. So I work within Blackpool. And I don't know whether you know much about the contextual area around Blackpool. And obviously it's, you know, somewhere that everyone's got fond memories of from childhood, et cetera, going to the pleasure beach and the seaside and all of that is great. And we're very proud of all of that. But it's quite a complex area in the sense that there are areas of, you know, really high deprivation, particularly in the centre of Blackpool, but also there are areas of extreme affluence on the outskirts. And indeed, you know, a mere 2 miles down the road, you're talking St Anne's and Lytham. For those of the people that are listening that are local today, will know that the vast difference between that. So in terms of working within a school in Blackpool with about 24% school meals, then up to, you know, a school that's got 75%, it's only a couple of miles apart. So would we have done things differently? Yes, we do. Are there things that we think of that are different priorities? Absolutely. But I guess a follow-up question would be then, do you think that accountability measures, Ofsted, etc., understand those contextual differences and take that into account, you know, when they are looking at the performance of schools? Because quite often, you know, exclusion figures are something that are analysed quite carefully, aren't they? And behaviour policies as well.
Yeah, I think, there's an easy answer to that. Absolutely not. And I can give you a great example. So as I said, I consulted in the education provision of a Young Offenders Institute. They are judged on exactly the same Ofsted criteria as you are in your school. Mm. And once you understand not only the contextual background of the young people who are in prison, and there's a lot of data in the book about that, and you understand the limitations that are placed on running an education provision within that setting, you quickly see that the Ofsted criteria is absurd. And I think, you know, the same is true of other forms of alternative provision. So no, Ofsted criteria is not a great guide. And no, it doesn't take into proper account context. And what you've experienced in terms of, you know, Blackpool there is really powerful, going from one context to another and going, we cannot do exactly the same. And I think once you understand and you can predict those differences, it becomes naive to go, let's copy that school and let's do what they're doing because it works really well for them, without really digging into how similar your contexts are. And that's why interventions that work in one place don't work in another, why behavior management routines work in one place better than they work in another. It's not that educators are so much better in some schools and better able to write clear behavior policies and better able to stick to them. That's not the reality. And I'm lucky enough to have worked in, you know, a selective girls' school as well that really almost doesn't need to have very many strict behavior policies, barely uses detentions. They don't, you know, it's not that the staff are so much better at delivering content or, you know, that they're more rigorous in terms of teaching behavior. They're not. Context really, really, really does matter.
Absolutely does. And it also, when we go back to that question about exclusions to be desired, tolerated or eliminated, and, you know, various different areas across the country have gone for, you know, trying to eliminate or completely stop the use of permanent exclusion, and giving schools various different incentives, whether monetary or training, to try and facilitate that. But even within a narrow geographical area, there can be huge differences within the demographic, as you talked about in that study. And I think that study was, I've got it in front of me, is it Goodman? Is that the study you were talking about?
Goodman and Greg, 2010. Does that sound right? I mean, in one sense, there are occasions where exclusion is a strategy. In fact, there's a fascinating study. It's not based in the UK. It's based in the United States, that took advantage of a really, really rare occurrence where 50% of all the students in an entire district were essentially moved schools at one point in time. And intriguingly, what they found is that that did not have much of an effect on the exclusion rate of the school at all. What did have a big impact was the movement of school leaders. So a head teacher effectively moving from one school to another, and exclusion rates tended to mirror their history rather than necessarily adapt to the cohort. So yes, exclusion can be a strategy. And I guess there are, you know, bodies out there that want to lower exclusion for sure and see that as a methodology of doing it. Now, if someone is doing it strategically, certainly as a consultant, you know, I can give them advice, but it's probably not going to be advice that they want to hear. What I do think gets then ignored or subsumed into that wrongly is trying to actually help schools with the volume of challenging behavior that underlies those permanent exclusion statistics. And that's real challenge to me. So I, you know, it's not a case of like, oh, you know, thou hast sinned because, you know, you've excluded X number of pupils. You know, let's have a look at your suspensions now. Let's have a look at the volume of challenge. Let's have a look at the context of your area. And it's not supposed to be about school shaming. It absolutely has to be about looking at the big picture, bringing in all of the other buckets, what I refer to as buckets in the book, in terms of knowledge that is outside the education sector, and doing more research in terms of within our education sector and building on that. Because it does worry me that we are effectively just doing and talking about behavior in the same ways that we could have talked about behavior 50 years ago.
That's fascinating. Okay, Kat, so just moving on. And again, having said I wouldn't talk about myself, I seem to have managed to do that quite a lot so far. So I might as well continue. So I go out and do a talk at research ed conferences, not through my work, Kat, because as I said before, no one's really interested in listening to what I've personally got to say or any of the anecdotes. But I kind of draw on the conversations that we've had over the years on the podcast. So I've spoken to a lot of people about behaviour because that has been the job that I've been doing up until Easter when I'm moving across to teaching and learning. So I have got obviously a vested interest in that. And one of the interesting things I've talked to people about has been about relationships and the effect that relationships can have on students' behaviour. I've spoken to Iggy Rhodes, who wrote and pulled together the EEF's Guide for Behaviour. I've spoken to Paul Dix. I've spoken to Tom Bennett. I've spoken to Doug Lamov. Lots of different people about behaviour and that idea that, you know, relationships are important, and everyone's there's a broad agreement about that, but it's whether or not relationships first before high standards, high expectations, or do relationships come as a result of the high expectations, high standards, etc. So meandering as I always do around to a question, how do caring relationships in school protect young people, and how do these relationships potentially buffer the negative effects of adversity?
Well, to be honest, I'm glad you asked that, because that's easier for me to answer than a question about high expectations. But because much as I've heard it said so many times, unpicking what is actually meant by that, I think, is actually quite challenging.
It's up there with quality first teaching, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Anyone can say it and no one can disagree with it. But what does it actually mean? Well, it means whatever you want it to mean, I think. Mm-hmm. So looking back at, right, here's the core question, why are relationships so important? One of the most challenging findings that people might kind of come across in the book is the research that shows the impact on child development when those relationships are not present very early in their life, when there's a kind of relational poverty early in their life, where there's a lot of adversity. And unfortunately, it very much appears that what is going on in the Year 8 lesson in front of you can be very deeply affected by what happened even in the first couple of months of life, which is not an expected finding. It might not, you know, feel obvious that those things should make a difference. But actually, in terms of brain development, it does, and certainly behavior. So if I tell you the study that kind of demonstrates this best, they had well over 1,000 13-year-olds who'd all been referred with behavioral problems to this to these clinics. And what they wanted to do was look at when during their life did the kind of serious adversity they'd been through happen. So they divided it up into four blocks. It was 0 to 2 months, 2 months to 2 years, 2 to 4 years, and then 4 through to 11 years. And what they wanted to see is, okay, effectively, the question I ask in the book is, does it matter whether you experience adversity as a one-year-old or as an 11-year-old? And my initial instinct would have been, well, at one, you're not going to remember it. You know, you don't really understand what's happening. At 11, you do. So I would assume it would be 11. In fact, the age which best predicted the severity of the kind of behavioral symptoms they were experiencing was 0 to 2 months. And then it literally went kind of down from there. So that is important for understanding. But one of the more powerful findings outside of this age kind of thing that they were looking at, the developmental stage, is that there was one factor that better predicted their behavioral outcomes over and above all the adversity. And that was what they called their current relational health. So yes, the adversity deeply matters, okay, for these children. But is it the best predictor of their outcomes? No. The most accurate assumptions we can make are based on the quality and the quantity of the relationships that they have right now. And that's a really powerful finding for us in schools. It does not mean that we can click our fingers, provide some good relationships, and change everything. And there are lots of reasons for this. One of the final chapters I dig into genetics and epigenetics and this concept of resilience and, you know, what might be the opposite of resilience. And there's a really great phrase that someone used in terms of epigenetics, and it's sticky but not permanent. Mm-hmm. And what we have in front of us and what we encounter every day are young people who've had experiences that have changed the way they view the world, changed the way they interpret the world, changed their biology, changed their hormones, changed their brain development. But these changes are sticky and yet not permanent. But that means it will take time. And that's a really hard thing for us to manage sometimes in schools, is the amount of time it does take to make those kind of changes.
Yeah, definitely. And then kind of breaking that down to sort of individual teachers or heads of department or leadership, you know, how do teachers go about kind of fostering those positive relationships? Is it more of a pastoral thing? Can it be something that is done within subjects? And, you know, back to that kind of idea of, is that the thing that we should do first, or does that come as a result of the kind of everyday interactions through, you know, working with the students in the classroom, for example?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the first question, the first part of that, there's a great quote by Dr. Karen Treisman, which is every interaction is an intervention. So rather than saying it's the role of SLT, it's the role of the former tutor, it's the role of the teachers and the middle leaders, think about it as being the role of the receptionist and the attendance officer and the school nurse and the lunchtime supervisor and every single person within your setting, because they can be the person who goes and checks on that young student at lunchtime, and they can be the person who greets the young student when they're late, and every single one of those makes a difference. You know, that's the suggestion. So in terms of, you know, how much does it matter, everything in this book would tell me that it matters more and more and more and more deeply, and it becomes more and more of a priority when you come towards cohorts that are disproportionately stressed. And that stress can come from any, you know, we've talked about free school meals, and there are other things in the book, you know, mental health, special educational needs, there's differences between racial and ethnic categories. It can come from anywhere. You know, we're about to hit a cost of living crisis, or in it now. There's a war in Europe. There are so many things that affect parents, and stress amongst parents affects, you know, the stress within their children. And actually, there's this kind of sense that if the child feels known and cared for, that that will make a difference before they are ready to learn. And the more stressed a child is, the more that matters. So I guess I'm kind of copping out of the like, which first question. I'm kind of saying it actually, it matters more and more and more, the more stress that you're surrounded by.
Yeah, and I don't think you are copping out of that question. I think that's the purpose of me going out and talking about other people's work, because there isn't a right or wrong answer to that. And yes, there are views on either side, but obviously everyone's in broad agreement that about the importance of relationships when you talk about behaviour. And that can be between adults, between, you know, adults and students, and between students and students, can't it? You know, in terms of the quality of those relationships, most people are in agreement that they really are important.
Yeah, I think that kind of brings it back to that term epistemic trust, and how much of our social learning is done through trust in others. So if you think about being a, you know, a brand new teacher, I think for both of us, that's going back a little bit.
It certainly is.
But I know that I learnt by watching other people. People said things to me and I took it on like it was the gospel truth kind of thing. And then sometimes I just cherry picked and I looked at that teacher and I thought, I want to be more like them. Did I really understand what I was picking up? No, but it felt like it was meaningful because it was coming from other teachers. So just the fact that they were a teacher gave that a kind of form of credibility. Now I'm in the nice position of having enough epistemic trust in other people to do that readily and willingly. Unfortunately, due to experiences, not everyone has that same level of epistemic trust. And in fact, you can have a high level of epistemic vigilance, which is where you trust very little of what other people are doing or what their intentions are or what they're saying to you, how meaningful it is for you in your life. And actually that transforms learning, because we are social animals and almost all of what we learn is through other human beings. So when that trust is diminished, learning is diminished dramatically.
Absolutely. Okay, so you mentioned before that about mental health, and one of the chapters in the book is called Misconceptions of Mental Health. And obviously, you know, as we go back into school, and we have been back in school this year following, well, we're saying post-pandemic, but we better be careful, because we're definitely, from my experience recently, we're very much in the middle of it in terms of staffing and student numbers, etc. But one of the things that a lot of schools have put in place is support for students, support for staff's mental health. So I found this chapter really, really fascinating. And again, it's backed up with absolutely loads of recent high quality evidence and research. So just share with the listeners your thinking behind the chapter, and if you can go into a few of the bigger misconceptions with regard to mental health.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the driving force behind that chapter, I guess, is a sense of frustration, really. So as soon as I started running a unit for children at risk of exclusion, it became immediately apparent to me that I needed to be a mental health specialist. That covered nearly every child, you know, who entered that unit. PTSD, diagnosed and undiagnosed everything, but ADHD, autistic spectrum condition, anxiety, depression. And what I found was, not only was I the one kind of trying to spot the symptoms and write the referrals, but I was living with children who were living with these such challenging conditions pretty much all day. And so I tried during that job to learn as much as I possibly could about mental health itself. And the deeper you dig, the more complex it gets. So in terms of, I think, major misconceptions around mental health, the first one is that they are not brilliantly defined. They cannot go very neatly into separate categories. In fact, symptoms frequently occur across different diagnoses. Secondly, how common it is to have more than one, if you have one diagnosable condition. But I think not waiting for that diagnosis was really key, because sometimes you don't get it, despite the fact that a clinician can recognize that a child is having persistent and very impairing difficulties. Sometimes they don't meet one specific threshold for a condition. Secondly, because the wait can be a really, really long time. And during that time, you can compound harm unless you act. So I gave the example of a young man who it took 3 years to get him diagnosed with ADHD. And during that time, he was off the scale in terms of punishments. I mean, every single day. And then removal from, you know, lessons. And then he kind of progressively self-excluded. And it's just a downhill path. And at the end of that, yes, you have a diagnosis, but you have a child who's had such a negative experience within school for years that it became, you know, an unrescuable relationship. And it should not be like that because a child does not have a diagnosis. So we have to get better at spotting persistent and impairing difficulties. Just because something doesn't have a label does not mean that ignoring it will make it go away. And actually, that's where paying very careful attention to the evidence in your behavior systems, assuming that you store and manage your data, is really important, because you want to spot these problems as early as possible. That doesn't mean you can click your fingers and change them, but you have an imperative to act where it is clear that the system is not working for that child.
And speaking of the system, and a bit that I've highlighted in the book, Kat, which is the SOS bit and the quote from Amanda Spielman, which was quite an interesting quote, I thought, in the current climate. So it's not reasonable to expect schools to be the main port of call for often highly specialised needs. And I'm sure that a lot of people are currently shouting at the podcast that we currently are definitely expected to be the main port of call for lots of complex some specialised needs, whether that's, you know, social, emotional, mental health, whether that's SEND, whether that's, you know, housing, whether that's poverty, whether that's, you know, lots of other things that schools are not necessarily the experts in, are certainly being asked to do that a lot now. Is that something that you're hearing as well?
Yeah, I think it's easy to feel completely overwhelmed by it, you know, and I think that there are certainly people within the school system, I mean, for me, particularly pastoral leads and safeguarding leads, who, you know, it would be hard to not feel overwhelmed. And that's the reality of this idea that we are just a sector. We are so intrinsically tied to what is going on outside of our walls. And the crisis in child and adolescent mental health services availability is something that I really wanted to highlight. And that is out of our control. It doesn't mean that we can't do better within our school system, but it shouldn't be like this. It makes up such a tiny percentage of mental health funding and of NHS funding. And that has been, you know, BBC News has been reported on that for years and years and years and years. So it is incredibly frustrating to know that a child has a mental health difficulty. It's just not enough of a mental health difficulty to reach an absurdly high threshold for someone from CAMHS to see them. And in one of the areas that, in one of the studies I looked at, 75% of CAMHS referrals were turned away. In fact, one of the things I kind of offer to some of the schools that I work closely with is some work on, it sounds awful, but how to write a really, really great CAMHS referral, because that could be the difference between getting the child through the door or not. But unfortunately, the thresholds in some areas are so high that it's like everyone's acknowledging that there's a huge problem, but we're also saying, well, it's got to get worse. In order for us to really provide what you need, it's got to get much, much, much worse. And that's a horrible situation to be in with children. And it's such a lack of foresight when you understand that the early years are when brains are developing the most, you know, particularly sensitive periods of brain development, you know. Just seems crazy to me that we wouldn't invest our funding there.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose I've got to speak from a personal level again, that, you know, we're extremely fortunate in the sense of the support we receive from both the local authority and the trust. So we have a full-time mental health counsellor within school, and we also have two mental health nurses provided by the NHS to work within school to manage some of the what are predominantly safeguarding referrals that come through to mental health team. But having that specialist trained person in school alongside two, you know, internal but external professionals who, like you said there, are able to tap into external agencies very, very quickly has been hugely beneficial for us. But, you know, even with all of that, we're still experiencing, you know, extremely high volumes of referrals into those teams. And, you know, it can feel overwhelming at times as well.
I think that's the key word there, Phil, is volume. And I can completely empathize with that. It's that you've got so many who meet that threshold for referral, and the limitations of, you know, what those people within your environment can actually provide. The volume fluctuates, you know, and all the evidence suggests the volume has gone up, as far as I know. So what within the system has been shifted, you know, in order to provide more of that specialist care? And there absolutely is a level where we need advice from specialists, and it can't just be managed through, you know, supportive relationships. Having said that, there's a great quote that I have spent ages trying to find out who said it. I can't find it. I could just tell you that it's too smart to be me. But it's essentially that an hour of therapy a week is absolutely no use if a child falls into a relationship desert for the rest of the week. And I do think there needs to be as close a relationship as possible between the people providing specialist support and the people who are working with that young person. Because like I said, I was surrounded by children who had very complex mental health needs. And, you know, working with someone, for example, with post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, hours and hours and hours of the day, it drains you, and you don't get supervision, or the vast majority of educators don't get supervision. You can't end a session because it's been an hour. There really aren't the same level of boundaries that there would be if I was, for example, a counsellor, and I'm hearing things that would be said to counsellors, and I'm watching children relive traumatic experiences, and there really is not the same level of kind of support in terms of educators who are having those experiences every day.
No, it's fascinating. So just moving on, Kat, onto the chapter around a broken system, and you've talked about SEN already in one of the previous answers. And one thing that I found fascinating was figure one on page 189, which is talking about the odds ratio of permanent exclusion by SEN provision. So in terms of, you know, without putting you on the spot there to be able to go through that, what are the links between the risk of permanent exclusion and students that have got SEND?
All I can say to that is really confusing and underestimated. I mean, I've literally, you know, it's not, you know, Edward Timpson's fault at all, but the report, you know, that's taken from his report, and some of the terms are out of date, and some of the terms seem to overlap, and they're not very clearly separated or defined. You know, he did the best he could with the information that we've had through a SEN system that has, you know, gone through changes. What I would say is that when we look at the relationship between having a special educational need or disability and exclusion, we definitely are underestimating those links. And there's two reasons why I can say that. So one reason is that we only look at the data based on the first listed need of any child. So for example, if we want to look at, okay, how many children who had a diagnosed mental health condition have been excluded, and the numbers for that are already high. What we're missing is every child who had a mental health need as their second or third or fourth or fifth listed need. Okay, so hopefully that makes some sense. You get put in one category only for the data, despite the fact that you might have multiple needs. And the second fact is that around a third of children who had diagnosed emotional disorders were not on their school's SEND register. So we don't actually, you know, consistently put children who get diagnosed with, for example, depression on the SEND list. So they are missing from this data completely if they were excluded. Have I explained that okay?
No, you absolutely have, yeah. And you know, you were talking before about, you know, if you worked in different schools in different contexts, would you take the same approach in both of those? And I said earlier on the answer would be no, and this is quite a concrete example of that. So, you know, once when I started at the school I'm at the moment, you know, the exclusions were pretty low, the fixed term exclusions were pretty low, but a disproportionate number of those, of memory, I think it's about 72%, were for students that are categorised as SEND. So rather than look at, well, what can we do in terms of, you know, further reducing the exclusions, it was about how can we match the educational provision to the needs of those students. So, you know, something that might have been considered to be quite forward thinking, this is not necessarily my idea necessarily, it was a school's idea and a collective one, was to look at, right, do we need what we called nurture classes across the 5 year groups? So we're probably one of the few schools that has nurture classes from 7 to 11 with a curriculum to match the needs of the students. Now, that was done to try and help them to access the curriculum, to access school. And we've had some, you know, notable success stories coming through that. But that was an example of, right, how can we cater for these students more appropriately, reducing the number of exclusions as a kind of byproduct of that, and not saying, well, we can just, you know, as a target, let's reduce the number of exclusions for certain students by stopping excluding them. Let's look at matching the provision to what they need, and also tweaking the behaviour policy as well. You know, we've got a separate annex for behaviour policy for students within those provisions, which is slightly different, although has the same kind of fundamental basics as a whole school behaviour policy. And we, you know, we have seen benefits of that.
Yeah, can I endorse that? Because obviously, you know, running a unit is something that I know other people will have experience of doing, like an internal AP. And there are some people who have a view that you should effectively keep all the rules that they would be experiencing in the mainstream provision, because that is the best way to reintegrate them back into mainstream. And like, this is only my personal opinion, but that is a deeply flawed way of looking at it as soon as you experience it, because what you would end up doing is sanctioning the child multiple times a day, every day. If you are going to continue to sanction them for the same things they would be sanctioned for at the same rate, what you do is accumulate sanction. And accumulating more sanctions is not a great way to reintegrate children back into the school environment well. Mm-hmm. So changing it, it's not just the right thing to do, it's evidence informed. If we go back to, for example, the things that I told you we've learned about poverty and the fact that it affects hyperactivity, that it impacts on attention, that it impacts on memory, why would we not adjust? What is our reasoning? And then sometimes it comes back to that whole, you know, high expectations for all, which is a pretty vague and generic statement, and actually is not evidence informed in the same way.
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Yeah, you know, go back to that point about that decision. You know, it's in some senses a brave decision that your school made to go, right, we're going to have a nurture group in every single year group. I completely accept that it is very hard at a leadership level sometimes to know what to put down, because, you know, on a very tight set of resources, a very tight set of resources external to the school environment as well, those decisions have to be made, because you actually can't just do more with less continuously. And so something has to get dropped. And it is very hard for people who are heavily invested in those areas to have things dropped. And it's very hard to know exactly what is the best thing to drop, so what will have the impact of dropping, you know, whether it's these meetings or whether it's, you know, shifting staffing. These are complex decisions and they are difficult. But again, using that nurture group example, I think that's fascinating as one of the better examples I've heard of behavior being a curriculum. Because it actually maps across 5 years. And one of the fascinating things I find about when behaviour is talked about as a curriculum is that, to me personally, certainly at secondary school level, it doesn't look much like a curriculum. And my example for that would be the way that a student is sanctioned and the reasons they're sanctioned for in year seven are for most schools exactly the same as they are if they're year 11. It doesn't develop. That's a huge age gap. That's a huge maturity gap. But what most secondary schools have is a set of standards that are sometimes called expectations, a set of standards and a set of consequences if you err in terms of those standards. Now, it's not sequenced. It's not developmental. There's nothing about that screams developmental to me, even through, you know, what's a huge difference in maturity. So I find that quite a fascinating debate. I mean, my understanding is it's far better in terms of early years education and primary education, in terms of teaching those behaviours in a much more sequential way. But like, you know, for me, secondary is my background and my kind of area of more expertise.
Yeah, and that is interesting because a lot of the leading voices around behaviour are advocating behaviour as a curriculum and obviously trying to teach behaviour, you know, both within the classroom setting, not just kind of that stereotypical right rules lesson at the beginning of the year or the half-term reset. You know, it's actually actively teaching that through, you know, the curriculum and through the subjects and through the kind of daily interactions as well.
Yeah, I mean, the last kind of version that I was aware of in the time of my teaching career where it was kind of much more of a structured curriculum was SEAL. Do you remember SEAL?
Yeah.
So, and there was some things to do with building learning power. And we're talking that, you know, there were lessons and there's certainly some things in PSHE, I think, that would fall under that category. Where you are actively focused on teaching just work around emotion or work around behavior or interpersonal relationships. You know, I think what it sometimes gets misconstrued as behavior as a curriculum in terms of the examples that's sometimes used are explicitly teaching some routines. And I have absolutely nothing against, I mean, I don't know how I could be a PE teacher and not explicitly teach routines.
Yeah.
I am all for that. but doing that, and then going over it is not to me the same as a curriculum in that sense. I guess that's the point I'm making.
No, I know what you mean. And again, in that talk that I do, again, shameless plug for own talk, you know, they do a lot of consensus around routines, norms across the spectrum. You know, no one's saying that they're necessarily a bad idea and can do a lot of good. Right, Cam, I'm conscious of time, so I'm thinking this is going to be the last question for you, if that's okay, but it's quite a big one. So something that people are very interested in, especially when behaviour is slightly more challenging, are things like managed moves and alternative provision. So what's the evidence around managed moves and alternative provision? Do they reduce the need for permanent exclusion? And, you know, are there existence, again, more evidence of this broken system?
I mean, well, great way to end with me saying, I don't know. in terms of the evidence that they reduce permanent exclusion, I guess in the sense that there is no requirement to permanently exclude a child who's not, you know, actively in your school. You know, you might be paying for that alternative provision, or there are, should we call it, more underhand ways of doing it, such as doing a managed move to a pupil referral unit. That really kind of refocuses the question on, are we just trying to stop permanent exclusion? Now, my issue is not exactly what permanent exclusion is or what it's called. It's the child being removed from a mainstream setting and put into a different setting. And sometimes those settings are not the best place. And that's no disrespect to the wonderful educators and the really dedicated people who have a huge vocation in the many, many, many forms of alternative provision there are. And there are a huge, huge, huge number. I think most people's default is to think PRU, or pupil referral unit, but actually alternative provision is vast. So it is very, very hard to unpick the impact of alternative provision in one kind of collective. So that's my way of excusing myself from not having the answer to your question.
Absolutely. Okay then, Kat. Right, so we've done the perfect thing of leaving the listener wanting more. So just a reminder that the book is The Excludables from Mainstream Classroom to Prison Education, Understanding the Children We Exclude and Why. And like I said, it's a John Kat book. So do you mind telling us, Kat, about where people can find out some more about you, whether you're going out and doing some promotion for the book, some talking at various events, or whether it's just something that they can get in touch with you through Twitter or social media, or if you want people to get in touch with you, just kind of signpost where they can do that.
Yeah, sure. So the book's available via the John Kat website, via the Amazon website. I think I spotted on Twitter that it's now available on an Australian website. Twitter is a great place to contact me. It is kind of a work account, and it's at Kat Stern, Kat with a K, at Kat Stern 4. And that's a great place to reach out. But I also have a website, which is katstern.com. And there's more information about the kind of work I do with schools on there. Bear with me, the website is a bit of a work in progress. But yeah, really, really interested in getting in contact with people who just want to further this kind of deep thinking about behavior and raise the level of discourse about what we're talking about. And really interested in linking up with loads of other areas, whether that's in terms of child poverty, whether that's in terms of mental health, whether that's in terms of social welfare and social justice, and all of these things do come into our thinking, but I really am trying to bring them into our like much more conscious and relevant thinking when we're talking about behavior in education.
Yeah. And I think it's a fascinating book. Like I said, you know, I've been through it once. I'm going to go through it again because, you know, there's so much in there. And I'll be recommending it to the team at work as well, particularly for us in our context. I think it's really, really useful book, and there's so much in there. And also, like I said, it's so well researched, it's so well evidenced, there's so many things you can take away from it. I just found it fascinating. So thank you for writing it.
Thanks, Kat. Phil.
Thank you for coming on today. Really appreciate your time, and yeah, hopefully we'll be able to invite you back at some point to unpick some more of this in a bit more detail.
Love to. That sounds amazing.
Great. Thank you, Kat.
Okay, take care.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Nailers Natter the Book. Ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Nailers Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.